Hello, I'm Yoram Chazoni, and this is NatCon Talk, where nationalism and conservatism meet. Today, I'll be speaking with Patrick Dineen, one of the leading voices in political theory in the United States. He is professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame and author of a brilliant and controversial book, Why Liberalism Failed. Patrick Dineen, welcome to NatCon Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, Patrick. We have an awful lot to talk about. We'll be talking about your book and the prospects for the appointment of apparently a devout Catholic to the United States Supreme Court. But before we get into all of those really big issues, I want to start someplace different. It's about 30 years ago that you and I were classmates in the Rutgers political theory program. I don't think you thought you were going to be a political theorist when you first came to Rutgers. And both of us were deeply influenced by the education we received there. Carrie McWilliams was your mentor for many years. And I don't think Carrie saw himself as a conservative, probably quite the opposite. And yet here we are 30 years later, and he's had this huge influence through you and a bit through me on political theory in the United States. Can you tell us how did that happen?
Sure. It is really quite remarkable that you and I both emerged from the same program at the same time. We didn't actually know each other very well at all. I think we may have only had one class together. I was actually an undergraduate at Rutgers, and I was an English major, not a political science major. But I took more or less every class that Carrie McWilliams taught when I was an undergraduate. I was pointed in his direction when I was a freshman, and I just adored him. He was really one of the greatest teachers, I think, ever to walk the earth, and really just genuinely a deep, profound thinker, but also someone who could really connect with his students. Carrie suggested, as I made my way through undergraduate studies, that I should go off to the University of Chicago and study with his friend Alan in the Committee on Social Thought. That was Alan Bloom. And I did that. I spent a year studying in the Committee on Social Thought, and decided, as remarkable and impressive as that program was, that what I really wanted to do was to study with Carrie. So I did, in fact, return to Rutgers, and with every intention of being a political theorist. And you know, you're right. Carrie considers himself definitely a man of the left, but an older left. He was an FDR kind of Democrat. And so when it came to sort of the social issues, he was actually, I think, fairly conservative. But beyond that, I would point to the kind of interesting influences in Carrie's own intellectual formation. He was a student of Sheldon Wolins, who was a famous leftist, one of the leaders of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement. But he also was deeply impressed by and influenced by the thought of Leo Strauss. And he saw himself as this kind of interesting blend of a kind of Wolin-Strauss understanding of Western political thought. But I think the thing that really distinguished Carrie in that world was that he accepted Strauss's division between the ancients and the moderns, and he identified himself with the ancients, and in particular with the biblical, the classical and biblical tradition. He was himself a devout Presbyterian, and so he was an unusual figure who's hard to classify on the left and the right, and I suppose to some extent I've inherited that something of that quality myself.
Well, you became famous, I think, let's say around 2012, with an essay called Unsustainable Liberalism, and then followed up, of course, a couple of years later with your spectacular book, Why Liberalism Failed, which has made you famous in some circles, notorious in quite a few others, but not everybody who's watching us is familiar with the scandal that is Patrick Dineen's claim of an unsustainable liberalism. Why don't you walk us through the basics of what does this mean? What is liberalism, the way that you're using the term, and what is it that makes it unsustainable, and what's so bad about that?
So when I speak of liberalism, and you know, especially if you have an American audience, they might tend to think that what I'm talking about is sort of the left side of the American political spectrum. When I'm speaking about liberalism, I'm really speaking about the philosophical project of liberalism in the coming out of the Enlightenment era. And the names John Locke and John Stuart Mill in the United States, John Dewey, you know, would figure prominently as architects of the liberal philosophical worldview, that translates into a political project. And the political project is, again, there are many ways that we could describe this, but one way I think we can describe it is that liberalism is really, you could say, it's a way of seeing the world in which all of the ways we exist in the world, and it can be through relationships, it can be through politics, it can be through our memberships that we might have in various groups and associations, all of those have to be, to the greatest extent possible, the result of our autonomous individual free choice. And that we have to shape and create a world that liberates us as much as possible from any possible influence upon the free exercise of our autonomous independent will and choice. And so while it posits that we can be strong members of different communities and different associations and families and so forth, it actually shapes a world that seeks to free us from all of those things. And you could even say begins to become a force for freeing us from those kinds of memberships, traditions, associations, cultures, and so forth. So it becomes a powerful shaping force that claims not to be shaping, that frees us from anything that's shaping. But of course, it actually shapes us. And it's really this paradox at the heart of liberalism that I really seek to focus in on. And the reason I call it unsustainable is that ultimately it breaks down any capacity and undermines any capacity for us to be shaped as members of communities, whether as members of families, as members of religious communities, as members of neighborhoods and broader geographic communities, and even as members of nations, that liberalism ultimately acts as a kind of acid on all of those shaping forces that in many ways are required for us to develop the kinds of characters we need to be virtuous human beings.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that human beings by nature, let's say, are not simply disconnected atoms. We tend to form families and tribes, nations, communities, churches, and we do that all the time and everywhere, pretty much, except in those societies where there is a constant pressure to tell people, no, the family's not important, no, the church community or the synagogue, the nation, those things are less important. What's important is, as you say, your own autonomy. Now, is this a description? I mean, it sounds a little bit at first glance like you're describing kind of Ayn Rand, but I think that you're actually talking about something much broader. You're talking about a broad liberalism that includes thinkers on the political center left, you know, John Rawls kind of a worldview, as well as the more libertarian thinkers on the center right. Is that right?
Really, the settlement that existed in the West, let's say, for at least the last 50 years, certainly after World War II, and certainly broadly the American settlement, was really between two different sides of the same liberal coin. And the debate wasn't over whether or not we were and ought to be a liberal society. The debate was over the best means to achieve that. And to boil it down somewhat simplistically, the people called conservatives argued that the free marketplace, the unfettered marketplace, was the place where we could best and appropriately act as these unfettered individual choosers, the sovereign autonomous chooser of the liberal imagination, while somehow sequestering family and civil life from the potentially baleful influences of that philosophic worldview. Whereas the progressive left viewed the state as the best means of liberating us, especially from the kinds of social and civil institutions that they regarded as the greater threat to our individual liberty. But in point of fact, what really seemed to me has been happening for the last at least half century was that you would have an oscillation of one of those two parties of liberalism governing for a time, and they would succeed in the liberal part of their agenda, so that the notional conservatives would succeed in creating an ever more open free marketplace that expanded, became globalized, free trade agreements became the order of the day, but would have very little success in preserving or even shoring up the strength and vitality of family of religion, of neighborhood, and so forth. And vice versa, the progressives were able to strengthen an increasingly liberal state without in really any effective way being able to restrain the more corrosive parts of the market. So really, while we've enacted this almost kabuki dance of oppositional parties in the United States for the last 50 years, what was really winning was liberalism. And the argument in my book is that over time, liberalism becomes fully itself. And when it becomes fully itself, it succeeds, but it fails. And that's really the kernel of the argument in my book. Liberalism fails precisely because it succeeds.
So if we look at, let's say, the period beginning in the 1960s, I think that's roughly the time that you can point to where these two liberal political parties, a liberal left and a liberal right, create kind of a two-party hegemonic liberalism, which declares itself to be, you know, the American worldview, leaving out, you know, more traditional Burkean conservatives, let's say, on one side, leaving out kind of a socialist worldview on the other side. And that's lasted, you know, that lasted, I don't know, 50, 60 years, that dominion of hegemonic liberalism. Today, it seems like that is under severe fire, not only from nationalists on the right, you know, the kind of Trump, Brexit worldview that is skeptical of this hegemonic liberalism. You know, maybe around 2016, it looked like that would be the main challenge to liberalism. But at this point, after the summer of 2020, we've gotten to see major liberal institutions like the New York Times or Princeton University kind of be stampeded by a young neo-Marxist or updated Marxist kind of a movement that wants to overthrow the power structure. And those are certainly not liberals of the kind that you wrote about in your book. They want a revolution. They want the liberal power structure to be torn down and replaced by something else. So you didn't get to that in your book. How do you see this this updated Marxist wannabe revolution as it's storming the liberal strongholds in America?
I think on the one hand, that's right, that what we're seeing is a kind of certainly a critique of the old centrist liberalism on both the left and the right. But I think that what we're seeing on the right in particular in the development of various iterations of a post-liberal conservatism is a genuine attempt to craft an alternative to this liberal understanding that I just laid out. Whereas what seems to me taking place on the left is a kind of intensification of what already existed in liberalism, directed at those institutions and those practices and those cultures and those customs that has always been in the target of liberalism. So it's a kind of extreme version or variant of a kind of progressive liberalism. And the funny thing is, even as it describes itself as socialist, it's actually not very social. It doesn't actually emphasize the institutions that craft and create sociability, the family, the neighborhood, the religion, the community, and so forth. It seems to be as fundamentally individualistic and antisocial as the liberalism from which it sprung. I've been reading a lot of Augusto Del Noce, as you may have seen me tweet about, and Del Noce, who wrote in the 1960s and 70s, I think he discerned that Marxism was really morphing into a kind of intensified version of progressive liberalism, a kind of materialistic hedonism that abandoned the Marxist vision of the kind of utopian, egalitarian, economic sort of flourishing that would take place after the revolution, and was really able to wed itself to a kind of capitalism that provided the kinds of hedonistic goods that modern human beings increasingly wanted in order to almost to define what happiness was. And it seems to me this so-called socialism that we're seeing is actually very comfortable in lots of ways with a kind of woke capitalism worldview. I mean, what's striking is how much the big corporations are melding themselves to this kind of identity politics driven, highly individualistic, norm breaking, anti-traditional worldview that seems to me to be really, as I said, a kind of intensification rather than a genuine alternative to liberalism.
Well, you're a professor at Notre Dame, which is a Catholic university, and I know that your connection to Catholicism is devout. You're a serious Catholic, and it seems to me that this connection to Catholicism must influence your critique of liberalism and your views of what's happening in the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Where does Catholicism fit within sort of the economy of Patrick Deneen's soul a little bit, and then connect to your political theory?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, Yoram, you took courses with Kerry McWilliams as well, and a lot of the critiques of liberalism that I have developed and argued for, I really learned at the foot of Kerry McWilliams, who himself was not Catholic, although he was very sympathetic and admired Catholicism, its theology, its philosophy, its tradition. On one level, I guess I would describe what appealed to me about Kerry's critique is doubtless because of a kind of Catholic formation that wasn't as on the surface at the time I was taking those kinds of courses as an undergraduate and as a graduate student. And like a lot of my peers and even members of my family, I might have drifted away from the faith if it hadn't been for a kind of almost an intellectual renaissance with my encounter of a kind of theological artistic tradition in Catholicism that really only took place in the latter parts of graduate school and then into the early years of my professoriate when I was at Princeton University. So in lots of ways, I think that my Catholicism, it turned out becoming almost in some ways deeper because of the critique of liberalism that I had initially been quite attracted to, and my sort of re-encounter, what sometimes we call a reversion to the faith, deepened, and I think allowed me to understand better this critique. So this is by way of saying that it seems to me you can engage in a kind of analysis of liberalism and come to very similar conclusions without necessarily coming from a Catholic background or Catholic position. But I do think that it is a part of Catholicism and a very central part of Catholicism that's informed by both the biblical Old Testament, New Testament, as well as the classical Aristotelian tradition that argues that we are by nature political and social animals. In other words, we are by nature creatures that are in some ways bound to one another, and that we don't become truly individual selves unless and until we have participated in and been a part of and been shaped by the kinds of sort of shaping institutions, civilizing institutions that we human beings need in order for our nature to emerge. So it's the exact opposite of what you encounter in the kind of state of nature philosophies of early liberalism that argues that you can look at human beings and their nature and see the fullness of the human person. Rather, we are creatures that become fully human through the kinds of institutions, through the kinds of cultural formation that makes our nature fully manifest and fully and allows it to grow to the fullest extent. So I think as a Catholic and as someone whose tradition is deeply rooted in that both biblical and Aristotelian understanding of the human person, it seems to me that one has to confront ultimately and think through what an alternative to the dominant liberal paradigm of what is assumed to be the human person and all of the kind of consequences that flow from that.
Did I notice you on social media talking about Burke and Disraeli recently? How do they fit into your thinking these days?
I think in lots of ways. So I'm actually writing a sort of follow-up book right now, and Burke and Disraeli figure rather prominently in this. I think you'll be interested, and I hope pleased about this, in what I really think has been a conservative tradition that has been largely lost. It may have never really been all that present in the United States, although I do think there are some strands here. But a conservatism that was self-consciously not liberal, that was self-consciously in many ways shaped not merely as a critique of liberalism, but as a genuine alternative to liberalism. And really, I think, you know, roots itself in this more kind of Aristotelian understanding of the human person that is, in many ways, becomes fully human through a kind of inheritance of practices and experience and customs and traditions that are not simply chosen, nor are they unconsciously practiced, right? We are creatures that interact with our traditions and our customs, and we're always interacting with them. We're not merely thoughtless sort of, you know, herd animals. We respond in energetic and often creative ways. But to think of ourselves as somehow separate or outside of those traditions is to mistake what it is to be a human being. And Burke and Disraeli, both writing as you know, the Enlightenment, you know, sort of launches its political project, and as it develops, especially in England, I think they develop a really rich way of thinking about an alternative way of considering politics, society, the cultural institutions of a place like England, as that which constitutes the human person. And here's what I think is really critical, is they saw these institutions, these practices, these customs and traditions as deeply and profoundly democratic, if I can put it in that way. In other words, they arose from the demos. They weren't imposed from above. In fact, what they feared and suspected was that the kind of Enlightenment vision of freedom had to be imposed from above, often against the wishes of the people who wanted to retain those institutions and those practices, which they had inherited and they had contributed to. And so in many ways, the Enlightenment project was an assault upon democracy, upon the kind of genuine democracy that Burke writes about as the kind of social contract between the living and the dead and the not yet born, the genuine democracy of generations. And Burke and then later Disraeli both develop this understanding of what Disraeli would describe as Tory democracy. It's a democracy that seeks to retain and conserve institutions, cultures, and practices precisely because that's democratic. And I find this to be just such a rich and largely forgotten tradition, certainly in the United States today. Although I do, as I said, I do think we have our own versions of this. And in that chapter, I'm talking about some of the arguments of the opponents of the Constitution, the anti-federalists, who echo many of these same themes in their concerns about what they feared was a similar kind of effort to impose a kind of top-down system on the American people.
So what we have to look forward to in the next book is a Tory populism, a populist Burke and a populist Disraeli. Is that right?
I mean, I think it's just trying to recover what is, in some ways, you could say, is genuinely conservative, as opposed to the kind of faux conservatism that we've, you know, that has gone under the name conservatism, but was really a variant of liberalism. And to understand that this conservatism is actually genuinely the alternative to liberalism. It's not simply a variant within liberalism. And in many ways, yeah, precisely to say that this conservatism is most genuinely a kind of great defense of the demos, of the people, of ordinary people. And I think it explains to a great extent why across the world today, across the developed world today, the demos, right, what is now vilified among many of our colleagues, the populists, the people, are increasingly moving in a conservative direction, precisely because they see a profound threat to the institutions and way of life that they deeply treasure and want to retain and preserve, and see a kind of assault from above upon what they have built and what they have inherited.
Patrick, I want to dive into a question that I know you've gotten it a few times. It's definitely of interest to our viewers. In the wake of your book, there's been kind of a recurring theme of people attacking why liberalism failed, and accusing you of wanting to undermine the American founding, of rejecting the American founding as a liberal founding, and in fact, of seeing the United States as a country that was misfounded, so that it's kind of, there's almost this inevitable trajectory from a misfounded America to where we are today. Does that in any way reflect your actual views on the subject? What do you have to say about it?
Well, I mean, it's some ways it's partially correct in the following way, that at least it was partially the case that the United States founding, in particular the constitutional founding, what had a healthy dose of Lockean philosophy that flowed into that founding. A number of our founders and the kind of fashionable philosophy at the time was really drawing from those Enlightenment, at least some of them, some of those currents were from that Enlightenment tradition. And it's fairly clear, and I try to highlight some of these arguments in the book, it's fairly clear that some of the most, what we regard as some of the most important arguments justifying our Constitution are really drawn very, follow very closely arguments that you can find, for example, in John Locke at the time of the founding. So, for example, maybe the most famous of the Federalist Papers is Federalist Number 10. Madison makes a number of arguments in Federalist 10 in which he indicates that the rationale for not seeking to ground the Constitution on what he calls moral and religious motives, that moral and religious motives of the citizenry and of the leadership are simply not reliable guides and not reliable presences on which to base the Constitution, but rather really what really needs to be operative is an idea of sort of contending interests in order to protect the contending interests within the broader society. The first object of government, Madison writes, is the protection in the diversity of faculties of men. In other words, to protect our differences is the first object of government. And the way in which our differences become manifest is different attainments of property. Of course, the essential and important right of property and with which I agree and I support, nevertheless becomes the first object of government because that's the way in which our differences are manifest. And I say this really departs from certainly, again, an Aristotelian, in my view, a Thomistic, or even a kind of classical understanding of politics in which the first object of government is to protect the common good, that which we share, and not that which in some ways divides us. So to the extent that that's a major theme, not the only theme, but a major theme at the time of the American founding, that's problematic. But it wasn't in itself necessarily so problematic so long as that strand was in many ways surrounded and limited by a lot of other strands that were present at the time of the American founding. Now, most of my critics who find my argument problematic, in other words, that we have become more Lockean, and we have defined the Constitution as more Lockean over time, usually criticize me because they actually share the view that the founding was in fact Lockean, and it's a good thing too. They actually disagree with me that the founding was wrong, precisely because they admire and they want to commend the kind of Lockean Enlightenment version of the founding. Now, in this sense, they diminish, it seems to me, the richness and the manifold strands that contributed to the founding. To mention a common teacher, Carrie McWilliams was fond of pointing out especially the biblical strand that contributed to the American founding. And he often called it the alternative voice in American politics. And any listeners who are interested because of our conversation in Carey's arguments, he wrote a very long book. The one big book that he wrote was called The Idea of Fraternity in America. And really the purpose of that book was to track and to trace that alternative strand, especially that biblical strand, which he regarded as seeking to undergird and to reinforce the centrality of fraternity. In other words, our relationality, our sociability. And that this was as vital a strand in the American founding, but as the liberal strand gained more dominance, as it became predominant in the American mind and in the American self-definition, that fraternal strand became diminished and became a sort of a minor chord in the American self-understanding. So Carey's project wasn't just to say America bad, something else good. His project, and I say I would share that project, was to say we need to strengthen and indeed to increase the volume of those minor chords and make them really much more major chords in our self-understanding.
I find the discussion, I mean, there's recently been this debate about whether Americans are committed to the idea that politicians should pursue the common good. And I have to admit that I am astonished that there could be a debate about whether American politics is about the common good. Now, it's true that you're calling the liberal strand of the American founding, I mean, certainly thinkers like Thomas Jefferson or Paine and Madison in certain moods can definitely be correctly read as moving away from a traditional Christian, you could say Jewish and Christian, a view that politics is about pursuing the common good of the society. But, you know, that at the time of the founding was a minority opinion. The Federalists, Washington, John Jay, John Adams, Hamilton, and the entire Federalist Party was very much still a Christian party. And some of the more radicals were also very much Christian. And that's the reason that the preamble of the American Constitution uses these terms like the general welfare, establishing justice, the common defense, the use of terms like common and general to describe what Americans understand their goals to be, I think is if not ubiquitous, I think it's dominant. Now, those thinkers, those founders are drawing from other thinkers. Many of them did read Burke, but there's also Montesquieu, who's a very conservative thinker. There's Vattel, who's a very conservative thinker. And of course, David Hume's history is a Tory history of England. And all of this in addition to the biblical heritage, which you and Carey emphasize. I feel like this is not a complete misreading, but a distortion, that beginning in the 1960s, American intellectuals wanted to see the American founding as a purely Enlightenment project. And that leads us to this point where, you know, today, if you talk about the common good, you cause an explosion. Or if you talk about the biblical foundations of the American Republic, you cause an explosion. And people say, no, you can't say that anymore. The question is, when did we reach that point where you can't say it anymore? I think it's very recent. I think it's the 1960s and on.
Yeah, I mean, you could track American history and look at it as like the frog being slowly boiled. You're right that it's sort of, you know, the frog realizes it's being boiled by the late 60s, but it's almost as if the more centralized we became, and you know, in my book I argue that there's a kind of interaction between the becoming more individualistic, liberating oneself from one's places, one's inheritances, one's traditions, and becoming more a member of a centralized state. And you know, in my speech that I gave at the National conservatism conference two years ago. How long ago? I really emphasized that nationalism by the 19th century really became the progressive project, because nationalism was seen as the way of disaggregating people from their localities, of liberating them from the particularity of the states, the towns, the regions, the particular places from which they came. And so there was a way in which the more centralized we became, the more individualistic we became, and vice versa. The more individualistic we became, the more centralized the government became. And the more this came to be the fact, the more the government, the sort of Washington, D.C., became this behemoth. And of course, this was occurring throughout the 20s, even in the late 19th century, and then the 1920s with progressivism, and then in the 1940s with FDR, and then in the 1960s with the Great Society, and so on. I mean, it's just been an ongoing process. The more this came to be the case, you could say, the more the language of common good fell out of fashion, because really what the government became was the umbrella in which we could all pursue our individual interests, right? So the more we became singularly this idea that we simply were all members of one thing, one overarching entity, right? So I think it was the 2012 election, the Obama campaign during the Democratic convention aired a television ad in which they said, government is the only thing we all belong to. And really, that really stood out to me, that's the only thing that we have in common now. But in a sense, what that was saying was the only thing that we have in common is the thing that makes it possible for us now to have nothing in common, right? It's to mention another ad, it's The Life of Julia. If you remember that television ad, or actually it was a computer ad, it was a set of slides you could watch online, and it portrayed the life of this young woman who, because of a series of government programs, was able never to have to rely on any other human being. Had apparently no family, came from no family, and had no relationships, but had a successful life because of all the programs that President Obama had created. So this is what government was able to do, was create a completely autonomous individual self. So, you know, this frog idea of the frog being boiled, what's interesting is you go from a country that's, you know, with highly various, a lot of different religious traditions, a lot of different ways of understanding ourselves in our communities. You know, the regional diversity was just extraordinary. Even the linguistic diversity, we had French speakers and German speakers, but even aside from that, there was a sense that we were all Americans, but we could also pursue the idea of the common good in these various communities in which we were participants. But the more we became these singular entities, these individuals whose sole connection was to and through the government, and whose individuality was created in a sense increasingly by the government, the more the language of the common good now became sort of horrific and unmentionable, because this sounded like something that we should all become, you know, the same, something that should make us into the same. And yet notice what the result of this has been, to make us more homogenous. To flatten out what it is to be an American now, to destroy the kind of regional cultural diversity that once existed in the United States, and as a consequence, to make the idea of a common good, oddly enough, now almost inconceivable to certainly the chattering class in America.
Well, I don't think that I know any conservatives who, I mean, literally probably not a single conservative of any stripe, who would sign on to, you know, the present administrative state, which legislates in place of Congress, has millions of employees, getting into virtually every corner of what it is that the way people lead their lives. I don't think there are any conservatives who believe in that kind of a state. That's a state that was dreamed up by Woodrow Wilson to allow experts to govern instead of the people. But the conservative interest in centrality has a lot to do with whether there is a government that is powerful enough, vigorous enough to be able to deal with threats from outside or crises inside. I think it's a mistake to see vigorous government, government that believes in the common good and thinks that that's its job, with large government or vast government, government that thinks that its job is to control everything. So let's take, for example, I was last week, I was speaking with David Goldman on this show. And David is, you know, a great believer in freedom and in the free enterprise system and in localism. That's not a man who's a socialist. But his argument is that the United States government has to face the fact that it's being overtaken by China, that Chinese manufacturing, Chinese advances in technology have created a situation where the ultimate existence of the United States and of democracies is in fact being threatened. And he proposes that government should be focusing, as you know, the Eisenhower administration did, and going forward during the beginning of the Cold War, focusing on funding and encouraging research and development of primarily weapon systems, but those things will have spinoffs in all directions. Now, you don't need to have a vast administrative state in order to be able to administer that program, and I don't think that it makes sense either to argue that there's a slippery slope that if you're funding R&D for advancing American capacities in engineering and weapon systems and basic scientific research, that necessarily means that you're going to have to be socialist. And I think that if we looked at the generation of the founders, you know, with the exception of especially of Jefferson, that I think that would have made sense to them to say there is such a thing as a national project that requires vigorous government, and that's not intended to take away the commitment to localism, the commitment to diversity and variety. Why can't those two things coexist? Because I think that's what we're being told today over and over again, is they can't coexist. You can't have a government that is active in helping deal with actual problems and at the same time not wipe out the self-government of local communities.
Yeah, well, you know, it's striking how that you began by saying you think that there's, you know, general, if not universal, agreement that conservatives are critical of the administrative state. But I think in an interesting way that's changing, and maybe changing fairly quickly, in the following sense. And I think it echoes what you were just saying. There's certainly, I mean, you can think of someone like Adrian Vermeule, maybe most prominently, and a lot of the writing that's taking place in the journal American Affairs is really trying to pivot from what was really just a kind of knee-jerk anti-government stance, you know, going back to the 1980s, that all government is bad, all government is socialist, to thinking about what are the ways that government is needed, especially today, in a different circumstance, is needed to secure the conditions for the common good. And part of that echoes exactly what you were just saying, which is that there are going to be areas where you're going to need something we might call industrial policy. You know, something that, you know, that Hamilton describes in his essay on the manufacturers, that you, in order to secure national security, production of certain kinds of goods, certain kinds of not only munitions and armaments, but also things like medicines, pharmaceuticals, that you don't want to leave to be produced overseas, as we've so recently experienced, that you need to have policies in place to ensure that those products are being produced here in ways that ensure a good supply. But I also think that there's growing interest in the ways that the administrative state is needed in part to combat, or at least to exist as a kind of countervailing force against some incredibly massive powers, especially in the commercial sphere. and we can think about some of the big tech companies, the Amazons, the Googles, the Microsofts, and so forth. Take Google for example, and some of the things Senator Hawley has been focusing on, do not always seem to have America's interests really at heart. Have been seen at times to be fairly fawning in their relationship to China. In ways that really raise questions about whether being an American company means anything. So in an age in which our relationship to China is becoming increasingly strained. And I also think that when we talk about the common good in economic terms as well, there's a place for a vigorous state in ensuring an economic system in which the economic playing ground isn't simply beneficial to the largest, to the most monopolistic players. Again, this was a part of the American tradition going back to the founding, that there's a mistrust for concentration of power, whether it's set government power, but also economic power. Right? You read most of those figures in the founding era, and they express as much reservation about concentrated economic power as they do about concentrated state power. And we're at a point now where you may need a certain degree of state power to restrain some of this concentration of economic power, but also to make it more possible for average people to be able to start and to run successful businesses in their local places. So in this sense, there's no contradiction between, again, as you put it, a vigorous government that has an administrative feature and administrative capacity, and strengthening both the national and more local parts of the nation that are essential for a thriving nation to persist.
Now, since you mentioned Adrian Vermeule, professor of law at Harvard, he's probably at this point the best known of the academic spokesman for the position that the American politics should, in fact, be pursuing the common good, that, in fact, every nation's policies should be directed towards some kind of common good. But I'm not sure that Adrian is himself sufficiently mainstream in all of his views to be projecting, kind of the mainstream argument for this. Because of my interest in nationalism and national independence, so it's caught my eye that Adrian is a strong believer in the idea that natural law leads you to the view that there has to be some kind of framework for world government, which is something that's very, very difficult and problematic from my perspective. What do you think? Are you what do you think about national independence? I know many Catholics who've told me, especially if they have, kind of a Polish background or a Hungarian background, they've said, look, historically, Catholicism is certainly compatible with national independence, what I call nationalism, a world of independent national states. But Vermeule seems to be saying the opposite. What's your view?
Well, I consider Adrian to be a friend, and he's also he likes to be a provocateur, and so he often establishes positions at the very margin of perhaps where someone would want to be making his arguments. But I think he does that in a way that clarifies exactly what he thinks are the logical conclusion of the arguments that he makes. But that said, I think he is genuinely someone who regards, as you just stated, the natural law, since the natural law is universal, since it is true by nature in all places and in all times. Therefore, there's no sort of theoretical and philosophical reason why there shouldn't just be one government that would govern in accordance with the natural law. But I think this is, while this is philosophically not untrue, I think it is politically problematic. And my position, I think, I actually share with Thomas Aquinas, who in many passages in discussing the natural law talks about the ways in which the natural law, while it is eternal and it is universal, the way in which it will be ultimately legislated and ultimately applied and promulgated will depend a lot on local variety and local circumstance. And this is why, like Aristotle, Aquinas expresses that maybe the political virtue par excellence, certainly for a statesman, is prudence. There's the need for prudential judgment in terms of the application of the natural law. And he, you know, Aquinas goes so far as to say there will be certain situations in which aspects of the natural law won't be possible or advisable to promulgate those parts of the natural law. And he says it may not be possible, for example, to outlaw prostitution in all times and all places. Probably where he lived at the time in Paris was one place where that was seemed unlikely, which is not to say that prostitution is not against the natural law. It is, but that there has to be a recognition, again, prudentially, of local and particular prudential considerations. And I think this in this way, not only is an argument on the basis of governing according to the natural law, which is to govern on behalf of the common good, not only is it compatible with more local forms of government, but it seems to me it's ultimately actually essential once we get to the level of human law and the application of human law, that ultimately has to be in concert with the natural law. The sort of demanding particularity all places and all times demand of legislators and of statesmen is going to require that there be a multiplicity of forms of governance. And so it's entirely compatible, it seems to me, to have the nation as one of the forms, maybe not the only form, but the nation as the most reasonable and the most workable form that we have come up with that somehow seems to stand, to use Pierre Menant's argument, to stand in the mean between the extremes of the polis, of the city-state, and the extreme of the empire. So I think even by Adrian's own reliance upon the natural law, there's good reason to think that more local forms of governance are essential in governing in accordance with the natural law.
Well, since we've gotten to the natural law, I think now's a good time to take up the current issues that are roiling the United States as of when we're filming this this video cast. President Trump looks like he's about to nominate perhaps Amy Coney Barrett, a extremely respected jurist, but who is also a devout Catholic. And arguments that we've been hearing for years are being trotted out, and it's about, you know, it's likely to become explosive. And the accusation, as you very well know, is that that Catholics believe in this universal natural law teaching, and therefore in some way they are impaired from being able to apply the law according to the Constitution in the United States. For some reason, which I think we could get into, for some reason, when it comes to Catholics and their natural law view, this drives people crazy. And I'd like to hear from you. What is, I mean, certainly there have been plenty of leading Catholics in American politics, from John F. Kennedy, and today we have Biden and Pelosi who are Catholics. But I think that there is a perception that those were Catholics who didn't take their Catholicism seriously enough for it to affect the way that they lead the American state, that maybe Catholicism was kind of private for them. Whereas Amy Coney Barrett, when she speaks about, you know, about bringing God's kingdom into the world, she sounds to me like an Orthodox Jew, you know, saying our role in this world is to advance our understanding of the right and the good and the true on the basis of our heritage. What do you think?
Well, I'm not entirely impartial in this. Amy is a neighbor of mine. She lives across the street. So we have a phalanx of reporters parked outside of our house on the street at this very moment. So it's been very, very close to home, literally. And I pray for Amy and her family, who are wonderful, wonderful people. And I know, based on past experience, they're likely to be dragged through the mud if indeed she's nominated. It's already occurring. It's simply the case that America, in more or less its entire history, has been a fairly anti-Catholic country. It was founded by people who were largely in opposition to Catholicism, different sects of Protestantism, to the extent that there was this Lockean strand. I mean, Locke himself said, all religions should be tolerated except Catholicism. Someone like John F. Kennedy was elected, he had to promise that his Catholicism would have no bearing on the choices and decisions he would make as president. And this was a promise that no Protestant had to make prior to, and hasn't had to make since. So there is a way in which America has always, in some ways, had an established religion. And it is a kind of Protestantism, whether it was a kind of older Protestantism or now a kind of secularized Protestantism, which, has become a kind of radicalized liberalism, that it is the case that Catholics have always been fairly suspect. And they're suspect for the reasons that I was talking about earlier, the ways in which, Catholics hold that we believe that human beings are by nature social and political animals, that there is a natural law that supersedes human law. I mean, again, in American history, figures have appealed to that natural law, such as Martin Luther King in his letter to the Birmingham jail. But it's a subject that's obviously, to some degree, it lies in tension with the American broadly liberal, broadly Protestant settlement. And even Amy, when Amy was when the hearings were held, when she was nominated for her current position as judge on the Seventh Circuit, Amy had to make clear that when she would render decisions, when she would render judicial decisions, they would be informed by her understanding of the Constitution, her understanding of the law, and that she would not seek to appeal to some understanding outside of the Constitution and beyond the written law. I think where we are likely to have, if Amy herself doesn't make these debates, I think where you're going to see a growing number of debates, we already see these, is the extent, these are already conversations that we've been having even here, is the extent to which the Constitution itself is a kind of reflection, certainly in some of its forms, a reflection of the natural law, that it itself is undergirded by an older tradition of the natural law. And you name some of those in the preamble to the Constitution, the appeal to justice, the appeal to the general welfare. In all of these various articulations and broadly the appeal to a common good, the idea of a common good is what? It is that there is a good. It's not in a good that we merely choose today because 51% of the population thinks it's good. There is a good. There is an objective good. And that objective good is one that we as a people that agree to govern ourselves together and orient ourselves toward, that the government has a positive duty to seek to promulgate, to support, and where necessary, to enforce that good. So the Constitution isn't, as I think it has been increasingly interpreted, merely a non-aggression pact for people to do as they wish. I think the Constitution actually does have a deeper foundation in the natural law. And so while I don't think Amy is going to stress this in her confirmation hearings if she's nominated, I do think that as part of thinking about jurisprudence and broadly what it is to be a legislator, what it is to be a statesman, what it is to be a citizen in the United States, I think we're going to have to become, and I hope we will become, much more explicit about the ways that America is a project, a political project, to secure the common good, and not merely a non-aggression pact of a lot of Hobbesian individuals who simply would otherwise want to destroy each other.
So we got to see this summer, I mean, it, it's sort of painful to bring up this issue, but we got to see a recent a Supreme Court justice appointed Neil Gorsuch in the Bostock case produce what I thought, having after reading his opinion, I thought it was one of the most tortured feats of reasoning that I've ever seen a judge apply in order to twist the law into some kind of conclusion that he believed it had to come to, even though the letter of the law didn't support his views. It's painful to see this kind of thing, and one would hope that no justices, regardless of what side they're on, would resort to that kind of twisting of the law. But now I'm asking you, with regard to, you know, if not Amy, then someone else, do you think possible, and this is, you know, I know it's a complicated question, but if you've got a simple answer, let's have a simple answer. Is it possible for a believing Catholic who is well-versed in the natural law to sit on the United States Supreme Court and to defend the actual Constitution of the United States without having to find some kind of crisis of conflict between the American Constitution and their Catholicism? Is it possible?
I guess, you know, to go back to what I was saying earlier, the Constitution was a document and remains a document that I think was and is grounded in a conception, a much older and deeper conception of the natural law, right? Which was certainly a strand in the founding of the United States. This would not have been a strand that was unfamiliar to our founding fathers by any stretch of the imagination. Now, I think what's fair to be said is that the Constitution, in the way in which it was understood, certainly by those who ratified it, was that the kind of, you could say, the morals clauses, we might say, some of the areas of the law that today, of course, are the most controversial, which often will, you could say, that the natural law touches very forcefully on. So questions of, you know, sexual identity, abortion, marriage, and so forth, that the Constitution was written in many ways understanding that those part of the part of the political order that would be most responsible for securing those institutions and those practices and those laws would reside in the states. That there was a strong sense that the states were the loci, were the locations where the sort of morals and police powers would exist, and that the federal government largely was to exist as a kind of institution to coordinate, especially in times of exigency, obviously to set up a national economic system. But in some of the areas that are most controversial today, that there would be a high degree of deference to the states. One of the things that I do wonder is whether, going back to something I said earlier, is whether one way we might best affect and follow the natural law today, from where we are right now, recognizing the need for prudence, would be to allow a far greater ability and freedom for the states themselves to reassume many of those police and morals powers. Now, this would mean you'd have a patchwork of morals legislation. California would be very different from Georgia and so forth. But maybe among other things, this could take down the temperature of the United States by several dozen degrees, in which now today, as we're seeing, when you have a Supreme Court vacancy, or when you have a national election, what everyone understands is that everything, all decisions now rest on the outcome of that election, or on who will be appointed to those to those empty seats on the Supreme Court. And it seems to me that as a political system, we in a nation as divided, as different, as diverse as the one that we have, we cannot function. We certainly cannot persist as a nation unless we take some of the temperature out of the room by, it seems to me, reorienting the Constitution in the way it was in many ways originally written. And I wouldn't be surprised. Amy's known for being a person interested in federalism, among other things. And it wouldn't surprise me if she ended up being a jurist that thought the Supreme Court ought not to necessarily answer all these questions, but allow for a degree of diversity within America to settle those questions on more local levels.
Well, we know why American federalism kind of petered out. I mean, you know, people still talk about it as though America is a federated republic, but it isn't really true. And every issue that is seems to be of decisive importance does end up in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has this tendency to make decisions for everyone and to ignore the possibility of federalism. We know how we got here. It's because of the fact that that the states continued to maintain slavery, and then even after maintaining slavery, they continued to maintain all sorts of other legal provisions, institutions for oppressing blacks and denying them the possibility of a decent life in many of the states in the United States. So I think that most conservatives that I know today are sympathetic to the 1960s agenda, at least to that extent, that they're happy that the federal government intervened in order to try to put an end to that kind of oppression of blacks in the South, let's say. The problem is that rather than taking on one particularly horrible instance in which maybe federal interference was justified, the result was sweeping, you know, as Christopher Caldwell writes in his new book, sort of the imposition of a sweeping new liberal constitution, which covered not only the issues that, you know, that the black minority was suffering from, but an infinity, an entire, you know, world of additional issues. I think that you're
well,
right.
I mean, it seems to me either
the United States has to be able
settled.
To
Or
to delegate
there's some kind of a crack up
to the state level and the local.
It seems to me
levels.
That the
without that it's,
it, it's
very
either or at
to
this
how
point.
America is going to continue. The question
you know,
is whether
I think you know. Of course, you're absolutely right, and it is
in the United States.
You know, truly one
for,
of the
for
know,
something
un,
like that
unspeakable.
Are the liberals
tragedies
of all kinds,
that word doesn't even do justice
willing to allow
of,
there to
of,
be
of American history,
states in the
a
United
nation
states.
Otherwise.
I mean, really,
in many ways. Founded and oriented in very admirable directions toward you know, a new way of conceiving of you know how people could govern themselves. You know, the first of the modern republics in many ways, but that it was founded also simultaneous to that as a nation that held human beings in bondage. And we have, we remain stained and deeply, deeply scarred by this issue. It has never been resolved. And I see it as an ongoing tragedy in the following sense, that I think because there was broadly, you could say almost close to being universally a belief something that Caldwell describes, a shared belief that outside of some pockets in the United States, that Jim Crow and the legacy of slavery, especially in some of the southern states, was a profound injustice, precisely because it had such moral authority as we went through the 1960s, that many causes that did not and cannot share the same level of moral authority attached themselves to that issue, attached themselves to the issue of how to eradicate the legacy and stain of racism, of chattel slavery in of the United States, to the point where now we have a decision like Bostick, which appeals directly to the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s, in order to say that there is no such thing as a man and a woman. And in many ways, I think one of the great tragedies is that because the issues that increasingly are attached to this profound American sin do not have the same moral authority, it actually is now undermining a genuine capacity once again to come together in America and to genuinely agree to resolve, perhaps finally, or perhaps at least in an additional step of progress, to resolve the ongoing issue of racial inequality of America. I think that there would be widespread agreement on the need to continue to redress racism in America. But now, especially with things like critical race theory, intersectionality, you have a whole panoply of issues and grievances attached now to the issue of racism that people of goodwill will not sign on to. Conservatives certainly will not sign on to. I think there's no difficulty for a conservative to sign on to an agenda that says we must eradicate every last trace of racism. But they won't sign on to it so long as signing on to it means you have to agree that there is no such thing as a man and a woman. And so I think in many ways, what we see now today as the root cause that's destroyed federalism at some level is also a root cause that's preventing us from really addressing racism as a unified country, as we, I think, we were on the cusp of being able to do several decades ago.
Patrick, looking in America, 2020, very, very difficult summer. Possibly opening up to a very difficult fall. Is there anything that gives you hope that you can share with us?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, I fear for my country in a way that doubtless like many of my fellow countrymen that I never have before. But I suppose no matter the outcome of this election, and I think the election is likely, no matter the outcome, it's likely to be both messy and will continue to manifest itself as a divided country. I think we're seeing the emergence of a kind of genuine, I don't know whether to call it post-liberal or something different than the liberal settlement of the last 50 to 75 years. And while many people see this as lamentable, as something to be decried, I think it actually portends something genuinely good, which is that if there is to be some kind of a revival of this American project, and I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility, it will have to be in the form of at least one of the parties and a significant portion of the American populace dedicating itself anew to the formation of human beings in exactly the kinds of settings, organizations, memberships, and institutions that we began by talking about. If we look across, the vastness of the country today, what we see is increasingly two Americas: an America that's doing very well, typically on the coasts and the urban areas, in the financial capitals and so forth, that by all social measures are thriving. And we see in America, especially in the heartland and the South, that it's foundering. People that are not able to form families, people that are, when they do have children, are often out of wedlock, that are addicted to various drugs or alcohol. In other words, by every measure, are not flourishing as human beings. And it seems to me that there's a deep and profound responsibility of those who are thriving to begin to pay attention to and to care and have concern for those who are not doing well. I think this is one of the great faults of what we might call the elites in our society today. I'm one of them. I teach at one of the more elite institutions. And yet, what I see on a daily basis is nothing but disdain and contempt for these people who are often blamed for their own circumstance. I think if we're going to make ourselves into one nation, it will have to be by at least one part of our political spectrum demanding that everyone has the right and indeed the privilege and that there is a widespread duty for human flourishing to be widely available, no matter one's education, one's profession, where one lives. And that this is something that every American should be able to share. And I do think that we're seeing the emergence of something of a political movement to make this, to bring this onto our national agenda. So whether that succeeds, at least it seems to me it's there in incipient form. And that at least gives me a little bit of hope for a possible reemergence of the great American Republic.
Patrick Dineen, thank you for joining us on NatCon Talk. Make sure you don't miss an episode of NatCon Talk. You can follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other podcast service near you. NatCon Talk is brought to you by the Edmund Burke Foundation, and White House Writers Group. This program was produced by Yoram Chazoni and Anna Wellis. Associate producers Rafi Ice, Hadar Achiat Chazoni, and Eliasef Yehuda. Our special thanks to Alex and Kathy Cranberg and Colin Moran. Check out our website at nationalconservatism.org. You can find us on YouTube at National Conservatism, on Facebook at National Conservatism, and on Twitter at NatConTalk.